Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry. I'm your host, Andrew Jelina. Joining me today is Vesa Tormanen, VP of Product Management and Engineering at Neurala. Vesa, welcome to the show.
Thank you. And nice to be here. And hello to everybody listening.
So you originally grew up in Finland with your parents working for a government pension fund computing center. What was that like?
It was like Star Trek, except I maybe was too small to watch Star Trek at the time. But yeah, my father was working often weekends and stuff, and I was taken along to the computing center with large IBM mainframes that were computing how much each Finnish person needed to get paid pension. And yeah, it left an impression. And then in primary school, high school, and thinking about career options, I never really considered anything other than computer science. Of course, then later on, also personal computers and computers that you could afford to have in your home became a thing. So that just enforced my decision to work with computers. Of course, now it's very disappointing because they are so small. You don't have this football field sized air conditioned like humming thing anymore. There's just a small little thing in the corner, or maybe not even that. I've heard that the pensions are now done with cloud computing, so big computer centers. I don't know what they do there now, play football or something.
They could probably calculate everything on an iPhone these days.
Yeah, well, Finland is a big government kind of country, so there's a lot to compute, but I believe they do it all in the cloud now.
Now, I think when you were learning to program, your first computer was a Sinclair Spectrum?
Yeah, that's right. 48 kilobytes of RAM. And the rubber tips on pencils as keyboard, but it was very small. It's kind of like we've gone back to the roots with mobiles and tablets. It wasn't much bigger than an iPod. No, sorry, iPad.
But that's the one where you didn't type the keywords, like every key was like a shortcut key.
Yeah, so when you boot it up, you got into the basic interpreter and you couldn't type commands. So each key was its own command, like basic keyword. When you pressed P, it just, you know, so it was like autocomplete that you could not turn off. It was kind of annoying, actually. They were probably really thrilled that they came up with this innovative way to make typing basic faster. But yeah, I didn't meet anyone who liked that thing.
Well, were you one of those kids typing in programs that they found in magazines?
Yeah. So they were these computer magazines that had reader submitted games and things that they would put onto the paper. And of course, you know, when you make a paper, there's going to be typos and stuff. And then you're so disappointed. You spent hours typing that program in and then it would error out and you would have to figure out what was going wrong. And yeah, it was exercise in patience.
Now, didn't Rare Games get started on the Sinclair?
Yeah, they made games for the Sinclair computers. They might have actually made even games for the earlier. So the Spectrum was already like the third or fourth computer in their line. There was ZX, I think, 80 and 81 before the Spectrum. So it was already like a massively advanced computer from Sinclair.
Yeah, Rare Games still around today, still cranking out games.
Yeah, I think they make games for the Xbox. They were acquired by Microsoft a long time back, probably, but I still remember it.
You know, having that inspiration when you were a kid, you must have been a computer science major in college.
Yeah, Finnish college system is a little bit different. Nowadays, they have bachelor's degrees as well, but when I was studying directly for master's, so I graduated with a computer science master's degree in 96, but I've worked full-time developing software already from 91, so I progressed pretty slowly with my studies and also did my military service in between, but I was a full-time student and a full-time programmer somehow all at the same time.
That's not easy. Let's see, that time frame, that would have been around the time that Linus Torvalds was making Linux famous, right?
That's true, yeah. So we were all running Linux on our PCs back at the campus, and we built a big campus Ethernet-based network. And internet was a thing, so all the universities were connected. And so their first massively multiplayer online games, there was one guy in a Finnish university who invented IRC. So there was lots of kind of social communication, Usenet groups, which is kind of like your predecessor to Reddit. You know, the first hacking incidents as well. I think our campus network was used as some kind of attack vector against Pentagon by some...
some ambitious undergrads.
Yeah, we were disconnected for a period from the internet even, and that prompted one of my university colleagues to develop SSH.
Ah, Secure Shell. So that was invented in Finland?
Yeah, that was one guy who was studying in the same program as I was. So he was just sometimes spending days and nights at the university just cranking up code. And yeah, he founded a company around SSH and it still exists. So I think he did rather well with that.
So for folks that don't know, SSH is Secure Shell, and used to be when people would communicate between Unix systems, they might use insecure protocols that you could read what was happening
telnet.
Between them. Yeah.
You would telnet.
Port 23. And then SSH did the same sort of connection, but encrypted. And this really opened up the ability to VPN or work remotely or make secure connections between these computers, and was open source. But as you said, he managed to commercialize it, make a company out of it too. That's cool. So after college, then what did you go on to do?
Yeah, I was developing software. And, you know, back then, when you had a master's degree in computer science, we had this idea that you should escape the actual coding part of software and move on with your career. So I switched from this software consultancy company to Nokia, and I started doing product management for software. So since 97, I think even until today, my primary goal in life, or working life at least, has been to try to turn software into software product. So that's what I've tried to do with varying levels of success over the years.
I think we could all say that.
So in the software product life cycle, there's the first idea, and then you kind of proceed, and then maybe you sell some, and then at the end of life, you have to kill the thing. And I think I still might be kind of negative on how many products I've killed versus how many I've brought to market. But I've always said that it's like killing old products is an important skill, because unless you free up the resources, you will never be able to bring anything new to the market. So
that's true.
There's a need for a hatchet job sometimes, but yeah, it's always nicer to create something new than erase history or get rid of something that was somebody's brand new baby sometime back.
So a lot of people had that experience right around the time of the dot-com bust. I think you were around San Francisco at that time?
Yeah, I was in Sonoma Valley, north of San Francisco. So Nokia had acquired a startup company there that was making DSL. Equipment, like you can still buy a DSL line from your telecom provider. So use your copper line for digital data transfer. So yeah, we bought a company that was doing that equipment there, and everything was going well. And the dot-com bubble burst. And then suddenly most of the customers that we were selling those boxes to ceased to exist. So that was my experience with the whole Silicon Valley rise and fall volume one.
The way you put it to me when we first spoke was that you had to actually divest the unit, and it's like sawing the branch that you're sitting on as a bird.
Yeah, that was a bit later. I repatriated to Finland, and I was heading a unit that was developing television service for mobile phones. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that too was one of these businesses that had its window of opportunity, and we reached some level of success, but not quite the critical mass for that thing to completely take off. And then as a result, then we had a divestment process, and I had the pleasure of participating in the sale, knowing that I was going to be a part of it. It's an interesting experience, especially when usually there's still stuff that you need to negotiate after this kind of divestment deal closes. Ceremoniously, in one meeting, I then sat down and then realized my mistake and went to the other side of the table to sit with the acquiring side rather than the selling side. But yeah, at that point, there are no more any secrets, because you know where all the skeletons are hidden.
Your stories remind me a bit of the show Silicon Valley there on HBO. There's a point where Hooli ends up stuck with all these boxes that they can't sell. That reminds me of your DSL story.
Yeah. I mean, in that case, in the US market, there was this VC-led investment into, they were called competitive local exchange carriers. So new companies set up to offer DSL services by leasing the copper from the incumbent operator, AT&T, Bell South, or something like that. And yeah, so there was this belief that they could do that. But then these big telcos figured out that, well, we could just sell these DSL things ourselves. And obviously, they don't have the hindrance of the margin that they would put on top of leasing these copper lines. They just priced all these competitive companies out of the market overnight. And that was that.
Not terribly surprising.
Yeah, those are these kind of stories that you try to bring with you when you move from one business to another, that there are these kind of inflection and leverage points that somebody might have. It's, you know, having experienced that, it's kind of obvious afterwards that, yeah, this was always what was going to happen. But when you're just in the thick of things, you don't really come to think that, yeah, they can just. In that point, actually, they were selling this DSL access at a loss to kill these smaller companies. And yeah, now they have monopoly. So as a consumer, data access in US is still very expensive compared to the rest of the places around the planet where I've lived. And I think this is partially the reason that the competition was killed from the market, and antitrust laws and those things exist to prevent this kind of stuff from happening.
So speaking of seeing in hindsight, something was definitely going downhill. We talked a bit about when you saw Nokia's business going down, when they were going to replace their OS with Windows Mobile.
Yeah, that hurts. Still, I think. So I was part of that smartphone growth wave, and it was an amazing time to be inside Nokia. We were hoovering something like 95% of the profit margin from the mobile business, which was growing like double-digit numbers year on year. So that was really amazing. And then you could see that, okay, all this independent, like once Android became a thing, it just opened up this whole market for competition. And Nokia had been a sort of monopoly in the smartphone space because they had the only operating system. But this previous competitive strength with Android being free and being extensible for all different kinds of smartphone hardware, it just opened up the market, and it was easy to see that the previous strength immediately became a massive liability. And yeah, everybody, me included, assumed that we would just go to Android because, you know, Nokia's strength was making great hardware. Also services on top of these phones, like what you have from Google and Apple now for music and navigation and all this kind of stuff. So that was everybody's expectation. So yeah, it was very surprising when they then announced that it was going to be Windows, and then, you know, they osborned the platform by saying that, yeah, we are going to discontinue this current thing in 12 months or replace it with this new thing after a year. So I still don't understand who could have just made that decision and not known enough of this early. We touched upon the Spectrum and the early computing history. So there was this famous computer brand from UK called Osborne, who did exactly the same thing. They announced a new product and then everybody stopped buying their old one, and it took them 1 year to get it to the market. And during that, before they got the new product to the market, they went bankrupt because they had built all these old computers and nobody wanted to buy them anymore because they had the new one that was going to be so much better. So exactly the same thing happened to Nokia, basically.
So they're running Symbian OS, things working, but then they're like, all right, this is going to be dead within a year, and then we're going to go to Windows, but still buy it.
Yeah, it's you know, Nokia didn't just shoot themselves into the foot when they did that. They also did the same thing for all the distributors, for all the retailers, for all the suppliers. Everybody was in the same mess. So Nokia had a fantastic kind of logistics engine, which, you know, kept them making all these profits, but then it doesn't work as well when you make everybody really angry. And you know, plus you end up with warehouses full of components that you cannot move anymore.
And they bet on the Windows phone, which I owned one for about a year, like an HTC one, because I figured, oh, maybe this will integrate better with Microsoft Exchange and everything, but it never really got there. There was never a critical mass of people making software for it.
Yeah.
You know, you had to bribe them.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't bad, but then when they brought it to market, there was already Apple, which was sort of this hardware and software built together approach that Nokia then tried to do with Microsoft. And then Microsoft bought the unit and tried to do it by themselves. And then there was Android, which was kind of like this PC model that you could have components from different vendors and put it all together and have Android run it and offer differentiated experience based on this has that much RAM and this kind of battery and that kind of display. And so it became kind of a component quality play for the Android vendors. Obviously, there was like an internal and external communication story how this was all going to go well. But already then, at least my business history told that there was just no way this was going to succeed. And it went even worse than I feared. So.
Yeah, it was pretty spectacular. 10 years before that, they're killing the market. They got like the Motorola candy bar. The thing's practically indestructible. Everyone has one. I think you had a story about how you accidentally tried to destroy yours and couldn't.
Yeah, I had a Nokia smartphone, the N95, which was the product that we had when the first iPhone came to market. And I had a handlebar holder for it. Back then, I was living in Finland and I was commuting by bicycle to work year round. And must have been like springtime or something. So there was no more any snow, but there was just black ice in spots. And I took a left turn with my bicycle in one intersection. It was just like a skating rink. So my front wheel wiped out immediately from under me. And I just nicely slid all the way over the intersection and stopped there. And I wasn't hurt. You know, I was like, everything seems fine. And I'm just like, where is my phone? And it's one of these things where you kind of look around, then you already know what's going to happen. There's nothing you can do to stop it. So I saw my orange phone holder in the middle of the intersection, and I saw a bus, which was too close for me to run in front of it to go get my phone. And, you know, when I saw that, I was like certain that, yeah, the bus is going to drive around, drive over my fantastic Nokia multimedia smartphone. And there goes my Spotify and images and all that stuff. And yeah, it happened. So my N95 was driven over by a bus and I went and picked it up and it was fine. There wasn't a scratch on it. And it certainly was driven over by this bus because it flew in the air when the tires went over.
It's just, and you pick it up and it's fine. Totally works.
Yeah. But I mean, the mechanic design of these mobile phones was always Nokia's primary strengths that they had. They had these test equipment that they used to really torture these devices, and every device had to pass those tests. And yeah, that was probably something that, you know, we would still today appreciate rather than buying these almost as expensive as the phone covers to try to keep the delicate thing intact.
I see people that have like a $50 OtterBox and they still have a cracked screen.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed.
Hey, sport. How was school today?
It was okay, Dad. How was work?
Ugh. Actually, I had a rough day. Leading an engineering team is hard. I mean, I have to ship new software, meet deadlines, and tackle new projects while keeping my team focused on the day-to-day. It's hard to keep up.
Jeepers, Dad. Why don't you call Syrinx? They're the software engineering firm run by software developers. They helped Billy's dad. He used to be stressed out like you. He was missing deadlines, his team was overworked, and a bunch of folks left the company because it was too stressful. But then he called Syrinx, and they put developers to work right away. He hit all his deadlines and freed up his team to do other work. His boss was so happy Billy's dad got some extra time off.
Time off? Wow. What did he do with that?
He spent it with Billy.
That's a swell idea, son. I'll call Syrinx today. Now, you go wash up for supper.
It almost seems like Apple's the new Nokia. If you look worldwide, they're 30%, Android 70%, basically.
Yeah, but if you look at the margin, they are like 90% of the mobile sales margin. So they sell the devices to exactly who they want to sell them to and leave the Android to sweep up all the corners of the house while they take the middle of it.
Yeah, I can see that. I've had an Android phone for a long time, and like there's a little differentiation here and there. Like, I didn't realize how good the Motorola voice hardware was until I got a Samsung. I used to do voice to text all the time for like dictating into Evernote or into a text message or email or whatever. And when I got a Samsung phone, it was suddenly atrocious. All the wrong words all the time, like having to correct it. And then I just got another Motorola phone recently and it was back to 95%+ recognition rate.
Yeah.
But yeah, Apple just does a good job of consistently delivering what they say they're gonna, and they've got a huge group of fans now. It feels like a juggernaut.
Yeah, I think though with Apple, there's two kinds of crowd. So there's the cult. And then there's the people who are just kind of, they gave up their little finger. And it's just such a high hurdle to move out of the ecosystem because everything is there. I never bought a Nokia Windows phone. I was so upset about the whole thing. I was using Symbian until I switched to Apple and I wasn't working for Nokia anymore. But yeah, so I've liked the Apple hardware, both computers and mobile devices. But yeah, some of their services, strategies are just, yeah, they're just kind of upset sometimes about what they do.
So tell me about what you're doing at Neurala.
Yeah, Neurala is a really interesting gig. I joined the company in 2017. So we were kind of a project shop for all kinds of visual AI projects. So developing custom AI for different kinds of companies. And I jumped on board. And as I said, I started trying to gather all the assets into kind of like a product process that would allow us to not have to reinvent the wheel every time. So we've had our normal startup, let's go this way, and okay, it's not maybe working as well as we wanted, let's go that other way as well. And each time we have the sort of distribution between how much of it is of the offering is product and how much is custom work has sort of tilted towards the products. And now since early last year, we've been fully on a product-based journey, so we are building AI solutions for manufacturing mainly. So using digital cameras and deep learning to inspect raw materials and components and ready-made products for defects and such like so that they can automate the quality assurance to a degree. Yeah, it's been really interesting. I was aware of AI and deep learning, but I hadn't really peeked under the hood. But Now I have. So actually did like a full specialization program on Coursera when I joined the company just to get up to speed quickly. And yeah, it's been a real interesting journey because AI has been this kind of a thing that it was already, I could have studied deep learning when I was at college, but obviously then there was no computer fast enough to run any of these algorithms that you could design. But then GPUs changed all that. And now you can have your Android phone or my iPhone has a neural processing unit, which is dedicated to running AI algorithms. And it's super fast. You can run really complex AI on handheld devices with very low power consumption. So why are we doing this industrial stuff is mostly because they have had a history in computer vision. So they've had cameras looking at their products and trying to figure out if they're the right shape and size or not already for quite a while. And so there's already the deployed base of cameras and deployed base of computing hosts where we could run our stuff. Again, making software products. And I can tell you, after all these years doing cloud stuff, it's not fun to get back into delivering software on a media. But,
So it's like a shrink wrap product? That's how it's delivered?
It's downloadable of course, so we are not actually burning them on CDs. But, you know, it's if you're comparing like one cloud deployment to having tens of customers running your software in basically every continent and languages and stuff like that. So, yeah, the support burden is very different.
How do you train it to recognize what is a well-formed raw material or finished product and what isn't?
Yeah, so that's actually kind of our differentiator in this space. So we don't, the user does. So we have, as kind of remnant of our cloud-based SaaS platform times, so we have a web-based user interface, which is kind of like Instagram or something. So you upload images and you associate them with tags, not hashtags, but just like classes of, okay, this is a good product and this is somehow a faulty one. And what deep learning allows you to do is then with a very small kind of set of examples, you can then build a model which generalizes. So it means that when it sees an image it hasn't seen before, it can still make a pretty good prediction on which class that particular thing maps to. And because we have come to this domain from the AI and SaaS company background, so we had good UX design as one of the cornerstones of the product design as well. So we have made it really easy for the end user to figure out, okay, now my model is good enough and I can deploy it. And yeah, so the idea is that you don't need to be a developer. You don't need to be an AI researcher to use deep learning in your day-to-day job. You can just be a guy on the factory floor doing it. And so far, it seems that we are getting good traction with that solution and story.
So I imagine you guys must be growing quickly and hiring talented developers. What sort of skill sets are you guys looking for?
Yeah, so we are growing, definitely. We are looking for, as I said, we use web technologies, even though we deliver on-prem software. So we use the Electron platform. I don't know if you're aware, so you can run web-based code. So basically our SaaS platform can be run in like a browser frame, which looks like a Windows application. So it's actually kind of amazing. It was at least to me when I first heard about it and saw it actually do that. So we have full stack like JavaScript. We have Angular and Node as our development base on that side. And then the core AI algorithms have been written with C++. So always looking for high performance computing, sort of CUDA, OpenCL type developers, or just very good C++ developers who are happy doing parallel processing and all that. So in the core AI stuff, even though the hardware has gotten good, it's always a question of like accuracy versus latency. So the bigger your model, the more accurate it will be. But then the bigger it is, the longer it's going to take to get to the next image. And in this industrial setting, your production line is going to move at some kind of pace. And then it's a question of, well, how much compute can I do before the next product is already ready for an image? So yeah, I think it's an area that is going to grow. The estimates are that it's going to grow something like tenfold in the next 5 years in terms of just business volume. And I think we are in it at the good time. So there's many companies are now kind of opening up to buying this kind of stuff, and we have a solution that's competitive. So it's exciting to be in that situation, but definitely the pandemic wasn't easy either. So, I mean, if you've tried to order a dishwasher or something like that during the last 12 months, you've probably noticed that the delivery times for stuff like that were just like 100 times longer than they normally would be. And it's been like the manufacturing industry and all their supply chains were hit with the pandemic. And obviously, when that's the case, they are not that open to investments into new technologies either. But they survived. We survived through it. And now it's definitely, we are seeing massive upturn in activity.
Good problem.
Yeah. Well, good if you can supply. That's the great thing about software products.
Now, what about hobbies? I remember that you're into restoring, tuning a Miata.
Yeah, so I turned 50 last year, and obviously the party was somewhat subdued as well. So I bought a Miata to have like a track day car. And yeah, I'm still kind of in the process of converting it. So I had to rent a temporary storage, and it has my rollover bar and some wheels and stuff that I haven't put on the car yet. But That was because when I was driving my new and shiny Miata from the dealer, I had a somewhat unfortunate incident with a stray deer on Mass Pike. So
what happened?
I was passing a big lorry or truck and was kind of halfway past it, or I had passed like the back half of it when I saw this deer. And my first thought was that it was going to be hit by the truck because it had stopped on the right-hand lane and there was two lanes. And yeah, it just was like a deer in the headlights, except that it was broad daylight. So it was a deer without the headlights, but still frozen. Yeah. So if I then had like better reflexes or something, I would have just braked and gone back behind the lorry. Of course, that's not maybe the best place to be either, because if the deer is coming from under the lorry, you have not a lot you can do. But anyway, long story short, the deer then at the very last second, it figured out that I'm going to be hit by a lorry and it sprang up a bit and then stopped right in front of me and on the left-hand lane. And then I had really nowhere to go because on the right, there's the truck and on the left, there's the divider. You know, there was enough space in front of the deer that I could try to pass it on that side if it didn't move. But then, of course, on the last microsecond, it darted forward and hit the side of my car. So rather than installing a rollover bar and better brakes to my Miata, I was installing new fender, new headlight, new door. So, it's all part of the process, I think, of tweaking a car. I don't really have facilities to do anything super complicated, but yeah, I'm planning on, once I have all the safety stuff done, you know, participate in autocross and high performance driving events here in Massachusetts and kind of get my kicks that way. I've done go-karting on these publicly available places, but they usually end up being just a very disappointing thing because they don't really take good care of the cars. So sometimes the wheels are just like massive toe out and it doesn't go straight, or, you know, you have so much oversteer, it doesn't turn at all unless you're braking at the same time. And yeah, it's just like you try to make good lap times and usually it's just very frustrating. So I decided I need to have a car of my own to try to do that. So then at least I can blame myself if it doesn't go fast.
So you put in the roll bars, you probably need an extinguisher, tune the suspension.
Yeah. It's already like sport suspension. And, you know, even the basic Miata suspension isn't really that bad. So I was planning on, once I have all the safety stuff in, I'm just going to like upgrade one bit by one bit and see how it affects the times. I think that's going to be the fun part of it, is like, you know, should I do coilovers? Should I do bigger brakes? Should I do, I don't want to tune the engine really. Yeah, I have survival instinct. And I think it might turn off when I'm in the car and I have a helmet on. So it's better if it's not going much faster than stock on the straights. So I have a little bit more margin in the corners.
Sometimes the best ability is availability. You don't want that thing to quit.
Yeah.
So Vesa, thank you very much for joining us on Underserved and sharing your experiences and stories with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's been fun to reminisce about the time I've had in this industry.
It's sometimes like dog years, but you have a lot of interesting experiences to show for it.
Yeah, and feels dog years as well. Like the 90s is a long time ago.
It sure was. And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.